ships, sailboats, and pleasure craft crisscrossed between England and Dunkirk, rescuing soldiers and going back for more. A newsreel put it this way.
Ships of all shapes and sizes, manned by sailors and merchantmen of Britain. We beat them back. We got our armies away.
George Kay was rescued.
It was an impossibility, but they did it. I've got a lot of gratitude towards those people.
Prime Minister Winston Churchill expected the little ships to save 30,000, not 10 times as many, says his granddaughter, Celia Sandy.
And if that hadn't happened, we'd probably be flying the German flag here today.
One evacuee recalls spirits were high because everyone was looking after each other. For NPR News, I'm Larry Miller in London.
And I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sit for Less, selling all colors of the Herman Miller Aeron chair online, including Sit for Less True Black, online at sitforless.com.
The punk-inspired band Green Day became so popular a new Broadway musical is based on its album American Idiot. Frontman Billy Joe Armstrong didn't expect fame.
I didn't know if I was ever going to play Madison Square Garden again. So I said, well, there's one way to remember this occasion is to be the guy that was naked on stage in Madison Square Garden.
Billy Joe Armstrong on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
Today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
WILL programming is made possible by the North First Street Association of Champaign, presenting the Farmers Market on historic North First Street, Thursdays from 3 to 7 p.m., beginning Thursday, June 10th, and featuring locally grown produce and meat, crafts by local artisans, and family-friendly activities.
And good morning. This is Focus, hour two of the show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Freyness at the controls this morning. Well, we're going to do something a little different here in this hour. We're expecting this morning to have live coverage from National Public Radio of President Obama releasing the White House 30-day safety review of deep water oil drilling. He's also expected to take some questions about the Gulf oil spill and his administration's response to the disaster. NPR, National Public Radio, will be providing coverage. And we expect that this will begin at about 11:40. So what we're going to do here in the meantime, and keeping with the psychology theme that we had going this morning on the program, is go to the Focus Archives and play you some of a conversation that we had last summer with psychologist Allison Gopnik from the University of California at Berkeley. We talked about her book, The Philosophical Baby. She does research on babies and how it is that they encounter and perceive the world. So we'll be able to bring you at about a half an hour or so of this show. And of course, if you want to listen to the rest, it's on our web archive. So do keep in mind that as you listen to this part of this Focus program, that we'll not be taking calls. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Allison Gopnik. She's professor of psychology at University of California at Berkeley. And she is a scientist that in her work is very interested in thinking about, trying to understand how babies see the world, what's going on in their brains, how they experience it, how they learn. And she points out that for a long time, generations, in fact, of psychologists and philosophers have believed that babies essentially were defective adults, irrational, egocentric, and unable to think logically. New studies, however, she says, demonstrate that, in fact, babies and very young children know, observe, explore, imagine, and learn more than we ever would have thought possible. In some ways, she says, they are smarter than adults. Now, what I'm reading here from is a piece that she wrote that was published recently in the New York Times under the headline, "Your Baby is Smarter Than You Think," and you can read much more about the kind of research that she and other people have done if you look for her new book. It's just recently out, so I'm sure that you can find it in the bookstore. The title is The Philosophical Baby, and the subtitle is What Children's Minds Tell Us About Truth, Love, and the Meaning of Life. Farrar, Straus, and Giroux is the publisher of the book. You might also be interested in looking at an earlier book that she co-authored, the book titled The Scientist in the Crib, which, again, tries to take a look at the way that babies interact with the world. And she kind of makes the argument that they're always doing experiments. They're very actively trying to figure out what's going on in the world and how they fit in. And if you're interested, you certainly can look at either of those books. Well, Professor Gopnik, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
I should say again, because you were here, and I had intended to find out when. I know it was a few years ago. You were on the campus and gave a talk, and you were nice enough to come into the studio to talk with us at the time of when The Scientist in the Crib, I think, was new.
That's right.
And I'm really pleased you could be with us. Well, you know, I think it would be a good place to start, perhaps, to talk in contrast with what now we are learning about babies and what's going on inside their heads, to talk a little bit about what had been, for a long time, the way that scientists, psychologists, philosophers had thought about babies.
Well, I think you could kind of click through a list of the things that philosophers and psychologists used to think about babies and what we understand now. Psychologists used to think that babies were irrational and illogical. And in fact, it turns out that even very young babies already are very good at being very, very reasonable and logical and making good inferences about the world around them. People used to think that babies and young children were egocentric, that they couldn't take the perspective of another person. And now we're discovering that even very young children and even young babies already understand a lot about how other people feel and think. We used to think that babies were amoral, that they didn't have any notion of morality until, some people thought, until they were adolescents. And now we're discovering that even very young babies already have capacities for empathy and altruism and understand a lot about the moral nature of the world. Mm-hmm. We used to think that babies were restricted to their immediate sensations and perceptions. They couldn't think abstractly. And now we realize that even very young babies already understand very abstract things about the world around them and the people around them. And finally, philosophers used to think, some of them still think, that babies weren't conscious, or at least that their consciousness was much very restricted compared to adult consciousness. And so dramatically that at one point in the past, they would do operations on newborn babies without giving them anesthesia. Mm-hmm. And I think we started to realize, although this is more speculative, that babies are not only conscious, but in some ways they're even more conscious than we are.
In the sense, and I think that that's a very interesting point. I think in the following sense, one of the things that you argue is that if you look at adults and you look at the way that we make our way through the world, we, and perhaps understandably, are very focused on what we're doing. That's in a sense, we have narrowed down the focus of our attention and the parts of our brain that are focused on what we're doing. The difference between the adult and the child is that the child is much more, say, wide open, taking in more kinds of information, different kinds of information, much more open to the total environment, and has not yet done this sort of pragmatic narrowing of the focus that adults do.
That's exactly right. That's exactly the argument. And that seems to happen in two ways. One thing is that babies just seem to be just generally designed to learn rather than to act and produce and to do things out in the world. In fact, one of the puzzles that we have is, why do we have babies and children at all? Why are our young so dependent on us and so helpless for so long? And in fact, human babies are helpless for much longer than the babies of any other species. And the answer seems to be that a creature like us that depends a lot on learning about the world needs to have this early protected period when all they have to do is learn. They don't actually have to do anything yet. So you get these kind of paradoxical babies who are brilliant learners, you know, can learn four languages at once but can't tie their shoes. On the other hand, as you get older, you have to take all the things that you've learned and put them to use and act. So babies seem to be just designed to be learners. But the other side of that is that there's a kind of intrinsic trade-off between learning and being flexible and being able to do something new and focusing and doing what you do effectively and swiftly and well. And it's almost inevitable that as you get to be better and better and better at doing what you can do, those habits are going to be more and more ingrained, and it'll be harder and harder for you to switch and do something else.
Mm-hmm. One other thing that seems to me to be an important point, and it goes to this sort of contrast between how it is we're thinking now and how it is we thought in the past. It seemed that in the past also, as people thought about how babies were learning about the world, it seemed to be very passive in the sense that they were just like a big empty bucket and stuff was poured into it. And I think that what you and a lot of other researchers are saying is, no, that's not right, is that for babies, this is a very active process. They are actively engaged in exploring the environment, learning about it, doing what you would call little experiments. And it's not the fact that they're just sitting there and the world is writing on the blank slate, as we used to say.
That's right. And, you know, people sometimes say, use metaphors like the blank slate, which was what the great philosopher John Locke said, or people will say, well, babies are like sponges. But that's not really the right description. In fact, we've discovered that even the youngest babies, even literally newborn babies, already have a lot of ideas about the world, including pretty abstract ideas about the world and other people. But in addition to knowing a lot about the world from the time they're very young, babies have these incredible learning mechanisms that are designed to let them actively make sense out of the evidence that they get from the world, let them actively make sense about what's going on in the world around them. And if you look at babies' play, babies playing, which we just kind of take for granted, actually seems to be a way of doing things to the world that will let them learn. Babies are almost literally, you know, hungry for learning the way they're hungry for food, and they'll go out and try and do everything they can to make sense out of the world around them.
Mm. Do you think that it is the case, you talked about how babies, they know things that we didn't realize before that they did. And so that suggests that there are some things we don't know exactly how, but, you know, to use the modern phrase, they're pre-programmed into the brain of the baby that they're just there. Is that what we think is going on?
Well, what we think is going on is really two things. So the first thing I think that we discovered was when we started discovering that babies knew so much in the science was to say, well, maybe this is programmed in the way someone like Noam Chomsky or Steve Pinker would think that language was just programmed in.
Uh-huh.
But what we've discovered more recently, just in the past 10 years, and I think this is really exciting, is that what's also programmed in are mechanisms for learning all sorts of new things that aren't programmed in at all. So it's as if babies, like scientists, never start out just from a blank. They start out with, say, theories about what the world's like. But they also start out with these very, very impressive capacities to alter and revise and change what it is that they think about the world. So both those things go together. Babies are born with a lot in their heads. They're not empty at all. But that very fact means that they can figure out all sorts of brand new things, things that no human being has ever known before, just by using their natural learning abilities.
And that starts right away.
That starts right away. So we have some really remarkable evidence in the past 10 years or so, for instance, that even very young babies are already sort of doing statistics. They're paying attention to the statistical patterns in the world around them. The way that two noises go together, or the way that one event leads to another event. Let me give you an example from some work by a colleague of mine now named Fei Xu. And she did a study where babies were looking at big boxes full of ping pong balls. And the baby saw a box that was mostly red ping pong balls, but with some white ones, so 80% red and 20% white. And then the baby saw an experimenter take some balls out of the box. And sometimes the experimenter took four red and one white balls out. That was sort of what you'd expect. But sometimes she took four white ones and one red one out, which is not what you would expect statistically. And the babies looked much longer at the experimenter when she did the unexpected, the less likely, less probable thing, than when she did the more likely, more probable thing. So that meant that these babies who were only 8 months old already could figure out something about what was likely to happen. They could already work something out about the statistics of the world. Even more impressively, she did the same experiment with slightly older babies, and then when she asked the babies to give the experimenter either a red ball or a white ball, they would give the experimenter and the experimenter had done the unexpected thing, it was as if the babies were figuring, why would she take mostly white balls out of a mostly red box? And they would actually give her the white ball. They seem to have figured out, oh, what that means is that, as strange as it seems, she must like the white balls more than the red balls. So not only could the babies see and figure out and compute the statistics, but they could actually use them, just like a scientist does, to figure out what was going on in somebody else's head.
Yeah. I think this is very interesting because one of the things that it says is that you can learn a lot by careful observation if you construct the experiment the right way. And not very long ago, I talked with someone here at the university who has been doing this kind of research, and we talked about this sort of classic thing where you have a baby and you show them a teddy bear and then you put a box over it. And apparently the idea for a long time was that they will believe, because they can't see it, that it doesn't exist anymore. Well, right. What she and other people have argued and said, well, that's not right. That baby's not stupid. They know that it's under the box and that you can actually construct what, you know, if you find a way to sneak it out from under there that they don't see, and then you pull it up and it's not there, they do a classic double take as if to say, wait a minute, there was something. I know that was there. You're not fooled. What are you pulling on here? What are you pulling on me here?
Right, but it's also this is Renee Bierjohn's work.
Yes, exactly. Yes,
great developmental psychologist.
Yes.
at the University of Illinois. But that's true. But it's also true that when you watch babies, so they seem to start out knowing something about, for instance, the way that objects appear and disappear. But as you watch, their knowledge and understanding of that gets to be more and more sophisticated. So, for instance, if you do an experiment where they see a large object being covered by a small object, will they predict that the large object's going to stick out?
Yep,
and that's
yep.
something that it develops more gradually. So babies do start out knowing a lot, but they also seem to have these capacities to learn a lot at the same time.
And again, I think that they're the kind of concepts that you would think, well, a child would have to be older to get that. Well, no, they will get that. Even quite young babies, they'll get that.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting because these are quite abstract concepts. It's not just that they're learning this is red and this is blue, or this is sweet and this is salty. They're learning quite abstract things like that objects continue to exist, or that people have particular kinds of feelings. So one of the things that we know that babies and young children are learning about the most is how other people work. And we've discovered that over the course of the first 3 or 4 years, babies are gradually developing a more and more complicated idea about how it is that people work. But from very, very early on, even from the time they're born, they already have some ideas about what's going on inside of other people's heads. Another mm-hmm. very abstract idea that we used to think babies only developed much later.
Well, I have several callers here. Let's talk with them, see what questions they might have. We'll start with someone in Charleston, and this was line one. Hello.
Hi. Thank mm-hmm. you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two short questions, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The first is, some of the language I've heard the guest speaker use seems really similar to Piaget's language. So mm-hmm. my question would be, how much does that her work follow from, and then how much does it diverge from Piaget, especially with this idea of the little scientists and the schemes that they might use to understand their world? The second question follows off that small discussion you guys had earlier about this possibility that we're born with some innate knowledge of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, have you been able to establish which concepts may be innate? And I think of the philosophers like Kant, who tried to argue that we were born with things like causality, quality, quantity, some of these basic fundamental concepts or principles of the world. Are there any signs that, or indications that any one of those or others may be innate? Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Those are both fantastic questions. First of all, about Piaget, I think everyone in the field agrees that Piaget was the great originator of this whole field of development. And when you look at what he did, and by the way, it was actually his wife, Valentin, who contributed a lot to this work as well. It's amazing that they could have seen as much as they did just looking at babies and young children. And Piaget's big, broad, theoretical ideas, the idea that babies are active learners, that they construct the world, that they're like little scientists. I think all those ideas are the same kind of ideas that we've developed now. But Piaget was, understandably, since he was, you know, working 70 years ago, understandably, turned out to be wrong about a lot of the details of what he thought were going on in children. And in general, he tended, even Piaget, underestimated how sophisticated children's minds were. So as I say, he thought that babies and children were egocentric and restricted to their immediate sensory motor experience. And it turns out that actually children are even more sophisticated than Piaget thought. So most of what Piaget said empirically, a lot of what he said about babies has turned out to be wrong. But the big general inspirational ideas that children construct and figure out the world around them, I think that's still very true. And what we've really started to do is figure out how to take those ideas and figure them out in detail with our modern more sophisticated scientific methods. So Piaget is still the great inspiration, but like all great inspirations, the sign of a good scientist is that other people come along and prove that he's wrong. Then in terms of the second question, that's a fantastic question, and I don't think we have a good answer to it. It's a really hard question to answer. If you ask me, my guess is that some basic ideas like the link between patterns of probability and causality are there innately. Probably ideas about objects are there innately. There's probably some basic ideas about people, like, for instance, the fact that people are like us. Newborn babies imitate facial expressions. So if you smile at the baby will smile at you. And that might indicate that this very basic idea that we're like other people are there to begin with. But I think it's important to say that one of the fantastic things about these human learning abilities is that we can overturn even things that we start out with. And that makes it kind of different from what people like Kant thought. So we might start out thinking, oh, people are like me. Other people feel the same way I do. But then when we look around us, we can figure out, oh, okay, they sort of feel the same way that I do, but sometimes they don't. Or we might start out thinking, oh, well, when one object bumps into another, the second object will move. But then we find out about all the exceptions to that. So we do start out knowing a lot, but we can revise and change and alter our view of the world with the same kind of mechanisms. And I think that's a very optimistic picture about how human knowledge works. One of the things that we've started to do in the last 10 years is we've been collaborating with computer scientists who are trying to figure out how you could get computers to learn the way that babies learn. And what we're starting to do is actually work out not just are there programs there to begin with, but what's the details about what those programs can do? And the computer scientists are discovering lots of techniques that let us start out one place and end up someplace that's really, really different. A metaphor that I like to use a lot is there was a great philosopher named Otto Neurath, and he said that knowledge was a boat that we build as we sail in it, like Ulysses' boat. And I think that's a good description of what the babies are doing. They start out in the boat of understanding the world, but then they tinker and they change this spar and they can alter this other part of it. And you might end up with something that looks really different from where you started. Hmm.
See, I think, again, that's something that's really, it's sort of staggering when you think about just how much flexibility, plasticity, ability to learn the baby has because, you know, to continue the metaphor, they continue to rebuild the boat. It's and to very dramatically come up with a completely new, or maybe not completely new, but substantially new model of the world and how it works, and be doing that maybe every couple of months. That's a remarkable thing.
Yeah, well, as I say, when I talk about babies being smarter than we are, you know, as a scientist, if I have what people sometimes call, you know, you get a paradigm shift every 20 years, and a good scientist might get a new idea every 10 years, and then you feel, my goodness, that's a really great creative scientist. We very blithely, as developmental psychologists, say, oh, well, here's what the baby thinks when they're 18 months old, and here's what they think when they're 20 months old, and then you think, wait a minute, that's only 2 months to completely change your view about how the world works. Yeah. So babies are showing this ability for plasticity and flexibility and change that's very deep. And there's another point to make about that, which is the great thing about us human beings is not only that we can learn all of these amazing new things about our environment, and in science we can end up learning, you know, amazing things like quarks and quantum theory, but the other thing about us is that we actually change the world. It's not just that we learn new things about it, but we use what we've learned to actually make the world different from the way it was before, and especially the social world. So we can imagine alternatives to the way the world is now, and then we can actually go out and make them be true. So that imaginative ability, that ability to say, all right, let's think about a different way the world could be, and now we're actually going to make it be that way, that's a very distinctive human ability. So it, and that requires you to have this kind of flexibility to think in new ways. I sometimes say if you just look around the world or look around the room that you're in, you know, look at the right-angled table and the light bulb and the chairs, everything in that room is imaginary from the perspective of someone who was a hunter-gatherer in the Pleistocene. Everything in that room started out as something that wasn't really there, just something that was in somebody's head. So to live and flourish in a world like that, you have to be very good at revising and changing and altering your picture of the world.
This is Focus 580. I'm David Inge, and the guest this morning is Allison Gopnik. She's professor of psychology at University of California, Berkeley. She's the co-author of the book The Scientist in the Crib and author of a brand new book that is titled The Philosophical Baby, What Children's Minds Tell Us About Truth, Love, and the Meaning of Life, published by Fair, Strauss, and Giroux. We have some other callers, and we will talk next with someone in Effingham, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, interesting, David. I had 3 things. The first would be if your guest understands or buys into the development, she has not said so far at what part of the 3 parts that the baby begins to develop in infancy. And then that enlarges, you know, into childhood and then on to the other 3. Of adolescents and young adults and then older adults. And the use of dialectic in the process, which that's all through nature, just as she's about the Pleistocene period, you either get smart or you're not around very long in the what we call the savage world, which, you know, are other species and such. And I'll ring off with a reference. Not long ago, you, David, had a program, and this gentleman articulated the psychological costs of learning to kill. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, I was astounded by that and the, how this man articulated the process. But your guest has some earlier perspective, I'm sure, but there is an example of the evolution of the learning process. And I'll ring off. Thanks.
Well, I think in terms of these big stages, I mean, of course, the development's different in different babies and children, but there does seem to be a point of difference between, say, before children are about 5 or 6 and afterwards. And across cultures, you know, in our culture, we send children to school then, but across cultures, people seem to recognize that children are starting to learn in a somewhat different way when they get to be, you know, 5 or 6 years old compared to what they do as babies and infants. And I think that may be the point where we start to get this transition from a creature that's primarily designed to just learn and be flexible to a creature that's designed to start learning how to do things well, start learning the particular skills and talents of his particular culture. So I think that's a kind of inflection point. And in terms of your second point, I talk a lot in the book about the development of morality in a moral sense. And one of the things that I think is really striking and seems quite plausible is that even very young children have a kind of instinctive reluctance to cause harm to others. That even very young children, even 14-month-olds, will help someone who seems to be in trouble, and even in terms of brain response, seem to respond with distress when they see someone else in distress. Interestingly, the one exception to this, sort of painful exception, is if you look at adults who are diagnosed with as psychopaths, they don't seem to show this kind of response. So I think it's a really interesting question about, you know, you think about awful cases like people being trained to kill, but, you know, if you even think about someone like doctors, I think it's actually, interestingly, very, very difficult, and a good thing that it's very difficult to cause harm, even when that harm's necessary. And that seems to be something that's built into children from a very, very early age.
All right, let's go next to Champagne, another caller. This is line number 3. Hello.
Thank you. I'm interested to have you discuss how this understanding should affect the way we go about child rearing. And related to that, I'm wondering if you're familiar with, one, the Harlem Baby College Project, something that was recently rebroadcast on This American Life, and also if you're familiar with the work of Joseph Chilton Pierce, and specifically I'm thinking about his book, The Biology of Transcendence and the Blueprint of a Human Experience, and what he has to say about how our enculturation and child rearing affects our later development and, in fact, why we're not able to fully realize the capabilities that come online when the prefrontal cortex, the last part of the brain, fully develops, why we don't have complete access to what's available there. And what he states about that is that that's very much affected by how we are raised from infancy.
Well, it's a good question, and a question people always ask is, you know, well, what does here's all this philosophical philosophy and science about young children. What does that tell us about the question about what we should do, how we should raise our babies? And I say sometimes, you know, in a way, the advice that comes out is kind of boring. It's that you should pay attention to your babies and love them, and that they need a rich environment with lots of people who are caring for them, lots of everyday objects that they can play with and explore and find out about. I think one thing that it does say is that this billion-dollar industry of quote-unquote educational toys and baby Einstein tapes and enrichments is a waste of time and money. But on the other hand, we spend lots of money on that, but we don't spend money to provide children with a very basic thing, which is an attentive caregiver. Our 20% of American children grow up in poverty, and we don't do anything to support parents and other people who are just there taking care of children. So something like the Harlem Project and other projects like the Perry Preschools in Chicago are good examples of the way that just giving children an opportunity to have caregivers who are paying attention to them, to have, you know, a bean plant and a goldfish and wooden bowls and a mom and a grandfather and an uncle and a couple of older siblings who care about you. That seems to be what babies and children are designed to need. And it's a bit painful that in the richest country in the world, we seem to have such a hard time giving them that.
Well, in the richest country in the world, we're way behind a lot of other countries in terms of giving parents time to be with their children.
Exactly. I mean, we have Europeans are just shocked when they find out that we don't have parental leave, for example, so that someone could take time off to be with their babies when they're young. We don't have publicly funded childcare or early childhood education. I always say, you know, I'm really pleased that my state spends millions of dollars on educating people between the ages of 18 and 21 because that pays my salary. But I can tell you that you learn an awful lot less between 18 and 21, maybe one millionth as much as you do between 0 and 5. And we don't do anything to support the learning of children between 0 and 5.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. You know, I think one of the things that when I see babies and they are sitting up and they're looking around at the world, I think sometimes the thing that tickles me is you see this expression on their face that seems to be saying, I cannot believe what I am seeing. You know, and again, I think I'm sure one of the questions that people ask all the time is, you know, you think about this state what the baby must be experiencing, seeing the world, seeing things for the first time, or seeing them with fresh eyes. Well, we're going to have to leave the program at this point. You've been listening to an archive, conversation with Alison Gopnik. We did this last summer. We talked about her book, The Philosophical Baby. She teaches psychology at University of California, Berkeley. And if you'd like to hear the rest of the interview, you can go to our web archive. That's will.illinois.edu. What we'll be doing right now is joining National Public Radio for coverage of announcement by President Obama. He'll be releasing the 30-day safety review of deep water oil drilling, and he is expected to take some questions about the Gulf oil spill and his administration's response to the disaster. That's now up next from NPR. It's 11:40.
This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm David Green in Washington. In just a few minutes, we're expecting President Obama to hold a news conference at the White House before he takes questions from reporters in the East Room. The president is expected to announce new safety rules for offshore oil drilling. Last month, he ordered a 30-day moratorium on new deep water drilling permits. Today, we anticipate the president will extend that moratorium to 6 months. Mr. Obama is also expected to delay or cancel plans to allow exploratory drilling off the coasts of Alaska, Virginia, and the western Gulf states. Federal officials now say the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico is the worst in American history. Millions of gallons of oil have spilled into the Gulf, and a panel of scientists have said the government and BP, the oil giant, grossly underestimated the size of the spill. We're joined in the studio today by Ron Elving, senior Washington editor at NPR, also Elizabeth Shogren, national environmental correspondent for NPR, and Richard Harris, NPR's science correspondent. Thank you all for being here to talk about this oil spill and talk us around the president's news conference.
Sure.
Good to be with you.
Richard, can we start with you? Because there have been a lot of developments today, the day that we're going to hear from the president, including a lot of new numbers that now suggest something that we didn't know prior to today, which is that this might be the worst oil spill in the nation's history. Tell us what's new.
What's new is there's a federal task force that has been looking at these numbers and trying to come up with a better estimate of the oil spill. The initial spill estimate was based on a kind of eyeballing the surface of the water and trying to understand how much oil seemed to be out there, and that came up with a number of about 5,000 barrels a day. Some scientists actually looking at the surface of the water said, no, it's maybe two or three times that, and people then, when BP released some video of the oil gushing out from underwater, scientists took a quick look at that at NPR's request and said, whoa, that's a heck of a lot more than 5,000 barrels a day. And so the question is, how much more? One of the big unknowns initially was how much was oil and how much was gas, and gradually we've come to understand that. But today, this federal task force came out and said it's at least 12,000 barrels a day, which is more than double the official estimate, and maybe 19 to 25,000 barrels a day. And I might add that some of those numbers are actually even best-case figures, and as they refine these numbers, it's possible, quite possible, that the figure could be over 25,000 barrels a day. But even taking these best-case figures, we're now looking at in excess of one Exxon Valdez spill, possibly two, maybe three, or even above that in terms of the volume of oil that's already spilled into the Gulf of Mexico.
And BP, the oil giant, just as these numbers were coming out, they've been making a pretty aggressive attempt to stop this with a method called top kill by pumping mud down into that well. I know they were watching today to see if at some point they could declare some success. Any word so far?
I haven't heard anything this morning except everything has been going according to plan. And plan really means, if you look at the videos of underwater, when I did earlier this morning at any rate, there's still a lot of this drilling mud that's spewing out the holes around the blowout preventer. That's probably good news, not bad news, because it means that we're not seeing oil spilling out those holes, or at least to my untrained eye, it looks like more mud than oil. But basically, this is what we expected to see from the top kill procedure. BP is saying that they are guardedly optimistic in a news conference last night that things seem to be going the way they expected them to go. And they also said, though, that it'll take maybe another day for them really to know whether they've succeeded. The idea is to take this mud, force it down the hole, the well that is clogged or that's flowing full of oil and gas, try to sort of push the mud down to tamp down that oil and gas and stop it from flowing. And if they can succeed in doing that, ultimately put in a cement cap and basically cap off the top of this well and end this spill that's now, in our fifth week of of spill. So yeah, it's a everyone is hoping that this is the success story we've been waiting for.
That the people have been looking for.
And yeah.
Before we turn to the Washington angle, Elizabeth Shogren, I want to bring you in, our national environmental correspondent. If these numbers are much bigger than expected, what does that mean for the overall environmental impact here? I mean, the sensitive marshlands that we've heard about, that the Gulf in general, fishing. I mean, does this make things a lot worse over time if the numbers are larger?
Well, of course, the implications are if there's more oil there, there are more implications for wildlife. Already, there has been oil washing to shore in some very fragile places. The coastal wetlands are the nurseries for fish, for birds, for sea fish. I was just talking to somebody who was watching an island that was surrounded by like a bathtub ring of oil. And on this island were lots of brown pelicans. Those are just recently off the endangered species list. And what happens is the birds dive into the water. They get the oil on their wings. They go back to their eggs. And just a couple drops of oil are lethal to an egg. And so that could have a big impact on this year's crop of eggs for brown pelicans and lots of other birds, and also implications for the marshes themselves. If they are inundated with enough oil, that destroys the very marsh, and all that's left over is open water. So the biologists and scientists I've been speaking to down there are really concerned. But so far, lots of the oil has stayed offshore. That's partially because of the dispersants and also because of the currents. If this oil changes direction because, say, a big storm comes in and pushes it on shore, there could be lots of really dire implications for lots of wildlife. And they don't really know yet what the implications are for those species that are living in the deep ocean, because we know there is a lot of oil still there. Some researchers I've talked to did see hundreds and hundreds of dead jellyfish. So far, we have seen some other dead animals, some dolphins, some sea turtles. But there's so few eyes out on this problem so far that it's difficult to know what the true implications are for wildlife.
And we're keeping a close eye on the East Room at the White House. Reporters have come in, and we'll bring you the president's news conference as soon as he begins. NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving sitting next to me in Studio 2A. And Ron, one bit of news today, that the first government official to resign as a result of this disaster, Elizabeth Birnbaum, the head or now formerly the head of the Minerals Management Service. If this disaster continues, do we expect more firings, more resignations like this?
There certainly will be calls for more resignations and more firings. One head will probably not be enough to satisfy the rage of the people in the Gulf region, people all around the country who are outraged by what has happened. And just as BP is trying this top kill method to limit the damage from the flow itself, the flow of oil, the spill of oil, the blowout, the president is holding this news conference and going down to the Gulf tomorrow in an attempt to limit the damage to his administration from the public reaction to what has been perceived as a situation out of control. Obviously, BP is the lead actor here in trying to shut down the spill. They are the people responsible for the spill in the first place. But there is a general perception in the American people that when something gets this big, this disastrous, the federal government ought to be doing everything that it can and succeeding in some measure in doing everything that it can to limit that damage, the environmental damage and the economic damage, and to somehow balance all of this with our unslakable, insatiable national demand for oil.
And you use the term out of control, and I think control is an important word. I mean, does the American public give the president some slack and say this is a situation where he just doesn't have control over oil coming out of a well, or are there expectations that he should be doing something?
I don't think anyone thinks the president can simply plug the hole or simply order the Navy in to plug a submarine into this hole. I mean, no one is expecting them to work a miracle or to do things that cannot physically be done. As Thad Allen, the former Coast Guard commandant who is still the National Incident Commander for the Gulf, has said, if we were to take BP out of the equation, if we were to push them aside, what would we replace them with? This is not the kind of equipment or the kind of engineering or the kind of expertise that the Coast Guard normally possesses, or has at least in the past, perhaps in the future, will look to the Coast Guard to provide this kind of service. But there is a sense that even if the president cannot stop the flow of oil, the president ought to be doing something to keep it away from the Louisiana shore. Certainly Governor Bobby Jindal of Louisiana is strongly suggesting the federal government hasn't done everything he would like to see the government do to boom the oil, to move it away, to try to pick it up, to do what can be done to keep it away from those breeding grounds and from the estuaries that are so important to all of this wildlife. And, of course, to keep it from destroying the economy of coastal Louisiana. We've got huge shutdowns in terms of the tourist industry. Grand Isle, very few people out on Grand Isle. And normally at this time of year, of course, they would be teeming with folks. So this is a potentially political disaster as well as an environmental and an ecological one.
Well, here in Studio 2A, all of our eyes are on the East Room at the White House, as are the eyes of the reporters who have gathered in that room awaiting President Obama. He's expected to hold a news conference any minute now at the White House. And before he takes questions from reporters in the East Room, Mr. Obama is expected to announce new safety rules for offshore oil drilling. And we're now more than a month into this crisis, Ron Elving, NPR Senior Washington Editor, and the president hasn't taken a lot of questions. The president has not held a news conference since that time. Does that surprise you?
Not particularly, because the president has not been having a lot of news conferences. If you're talking about the classic solo news conference with the president alone in the East Room in prime time, we haven't had one of those in 10 months.
And Ron, we are expecting the president in just a few moments, again, as you said, the first news conference he's given since this disaster began, and the president of the United States.
Good afternoon, everybody. Before I take your questions, I want to update the American people on the status of the BP oil spill, a catastrophe that is causing tremendous hardship in the Gulf Coast, damaging a precious ecosystem, and one that led to the death of 11 workers who lost their lives in the initial explosion. Yesterday, the federal government gave BP approval to move forward with a procedure known as a top kill to try to stop the leak. This involves plugging the well with densely packed mud to prevent any more oil from escaping. And given the complexity of this procedure and the depth of the leak, this procedure offers no guarantee of success. But we're exploring any reasonable strategies to try and save the Gulf from a spill that may otherwise last until the relief wells are finished. And that's a process that could take months. The American people should know that from the moment this disaster began, the federal government has been in charge of the response effort. As far as I'm concerned, BP is responsible for this horrific disaster, and we will hold them fully accountable on behalf of the United States, as well as the people and communities victimized by this tragedy. We will demand that they pay every dime they owe for the damage they've done and the painful losses that they've caused. And we will continue to take full advantage of the unique technology and expertise they have to help stop this leak. But make no mistake, BP is operating at our direction. Every key decision and action they take must be approved by us in advance. I've designated Admiral Thad Allen, who has nearly four decades of experience responding to such disasters, as the National Incident Commander. And if he orders BP to do something to respond to this disaster, they are legally bound to do it. So, for example, when they said they would drill one relief well to stem this leak, we demanded a backup and ordered them to drill two, and they are in the process of drilling two. As we devise strategies to try and stop this leak, we're also relying on the brightest minds and most advanced technology in the world. We're relying on a team of scientists and engineers from our own national laboratories and from many other nations, a team led by our Energy Secretary and Nobel Prize-winning physicist, Stephen Chu. And we're relying on experts who've actually dealt with oil spills from across the globe, though none this challenging. The federal government is also directing the effort to contain and clean up the damage from the spill, which is now the largest effort of its kind in U.S. history. In this case, the federal, state, and local governments have the resources and expertise to play an even more direct role in the response effort. And I will be discussing this further when I make my second trip to Louisiana tomorrow. But so far, we have about 20,000 people in the region who are working around the clock to contain and clean up this oil. We have activated about 1,400 members of the National Guard in four states. We have the Coast Guard on site. We have more than 1,300 vessels assisting in the containment and cleanup efforts. We've deployed over 3 million feet of total boom to stop the oil from coming on shore. And today, more than 100,000 feet of boom is being surged to Louisiana parishes that are facing the greatest risk from the oil. So we'll continue to do whatever is necessary to protect and restore the Gulf Coast. For For example, Admiral Allen just announced that we're moving forward with a section of Governor Jindal's Barrier Island proposal that could help stop oil from coming ashore. It'll be built in an area that is most at risk and where the work can be most quickly completed. We're also doing whatever it takes to help the men and women whose livelihoods have been disrupted and even destroyed by this spill. Everyone from fishermen to restaurant and hotel owners. So far, the Small Business Administration has approved loans and allowed many small businesses to defer existing loan payments. At our insistence, BP is paying economic injury claims, and we'll make sure that when all is said and done, the victims of this disaster will get the relief that they are owed. We're not going to abandon our fellow citizens. We'll help them recover, and we will help them rebuild. And in the meantime, I should also say that Americans can help by continuing to visit the communities and beaches of the Gulf Coast. I was talking to the governors just a couple of days ago, and they wanted me to remind everybody that except for three beaches in Louisiana, all of the Gulf's beaches are open, they are safe, and they are clean. Now, as we continue our response effort, we're also moving quickly on steps to ensure that a catastrophe like this never happens again. I've said before that producing oil here in America is an essential part of our overall energy strategy, but all drilling must be safe. In recent months, I've spoken about the dangers of too much. I've heard people speaking about the dangers of too much government regulation. And I think we can all acknowledge there have been times in history when the government has overreached. But in this instance, the oil industry's cozy and sometimes corrupt relationship with government regulators meant little or no regulation at all. When Secretary Salazar took office, he found a Minerals and Management Service that had been plagued by corruption for years. This was the agency charged with not only providing permits, but also enforcing laws governing oil drilling. And the corruption was underscored by a recent Inspector General's report that covered activity which occurred prior to 2007, a report that can only be described as appalling. And Secretary Salazar immediately took steps to clean up that corruption. But this oil spill has made clear that more reforms are needed. For years, there has been a scandalously close relationship between oil companies and the agency that regulates them. That's why we've decided to separate the people who permit the drilling from those who regulate and ensure the safety of the drilling. I also announced that no new permits for drilling new wells will go forward until a 30-day safety and environmental review was conducted. That review is now complete. Its initial recommendations include aggressive new operating standards and requirements for offshore energy companies, which we will put in place. Additionally, after reading the report's recommendations with Secretary Salazar and other members of my administration, we're going to be ordering the following actions. First, we will suspend the planned exploration of two locations off the coast of Alaska. Second, we will cancel the pending lease sale in the Gulf of Mexico and the proposed lease sale off the coast of Virginia. Third, we will continue the existing moratorium and suspend the issuance of new permits to drill new deepwater wells for 6 months. And four, we will suspend action on 33 deepwater exploratory wells currently being drilled in the Gulf of Mexico. What's also been made clear from this disaster is that for years, the oil and gas industry has leveraged such power that they have effectively been allowed to regulate themselves. One example, under current law, the Interior Department has only 30 days to review an exploration plan submitted by an oil company. That leaves no time for the appropriate environmental review. The result is they are continually waived. And this is just one example of a law that was tailored by the industry to serve their needs instead of the public's. So Congress needs to address these issues as soon as possible, and my administration will work with them to do so. Still, preventing such a catastrophe in the future will require further study and deeper reform. That's why last Friday, I also signed an executive order establishing the National Commission on the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill and offshore drilling. While there are a number of ongoing investigations, including an independent review by the National Academy of Engineering, the purpose of this commission is to consider both the root causes of the disaster and offer options on what safety and environmental precautions are necessary. if the laws on our books are inadequate to prevent such a spill, or if we did not enforce those laws, then I want to know. I want to know what worked and what didn't work in our response to the disaster, and where oversight of the oil and gas industry broke down. Let me make one final point. More than anything else, this economic and environmental tragedy, and it's a tragedy, underscores the urgent need for this nation to develop clean, renewable sources of energy. Doing so will not only reduce threats to our environment, it will create a new homegrown American industry that can lead to countless new businesses and new jobs. We've talked about doing this for decades, and we've made significant strides over the last year when it comes to investing in renewable energy and energy efficiency. The House of Representatives has already passed a bill that would finally jumpstart a permanent transition to a clean energy economy. And there is currently a plan in the Senate, a plan that was developed with ideas from Democrats and Republicans, that would achieve the same goal. If nothing else, this disaster should serve as a wake-up call that it's time to move forward on this legislation.